So good morning. This is Chair Rena Moran, pursuant to House Rule 10.01. I call this remote meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll for attendance.
Chair Moran?
Present.
Moran, present. Vice Chair Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Garofalo?
Present.
Garofalo, present. Representative Albright?
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
Becker Finn, present. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Eklund?
Present.
Eklund, present. Representative Hansen?
Present.
Hansen, present. Representative Hassan? Representative Hassan? Representative Hertas?
Hertas present.
Hertas present. Representative Hornstein?
Present.
Hornstein present. Representative Johnson?
Present.
Johnson present. Representative Kreisha?
Present.
Kreisha present. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Liebling present. Representative Lilly?
Lilly present.
Lilly present. Representative Mariani? Representative Mariani? Representative Marquardt?
Present.
Marquardt, present. Representative Miller?
Present.
Miller, present. Representative Nash?
Present.
Nash, present. Representative Nelson?
Present.
Nelson, present. Representative Neuer? Representative Neuer? Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, present.
Pawlowski, present. Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Pinto, present. Representative Schumacher, excused. Representative Schultz?
Present.
Schultz, present. Representative Scott, excused. Representative Sundin?
Present.
Sundin, present. Representative Hassan? Representative Mariani? Representative Noor?
Noor, present.
Noor, present. That concludes the roll. There is a quorum present.
Wonderful. A quorum is present. So our first agenda item is approval of the minutes for my hearing on Monday, February the 22nd. Are there any questions or corrections on the minutes? If not, the chair will entertain a motion to approve.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Noor moves approval of the minutes for February the 22nd, 2021. Could everyone please unmute yourself briefly for a voice vote? All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Well, members, we have one item of business today, and that is to go over the February forecasts, which will serve as the baseline for our budget resolution for March the 22nd. Commissioner Showalter and his team from MMB are here to walk us through the forecast finding and to take questions. You know, as Chair of the Ways and Means, I'm a little bit excited about the February forecast. I believe it allows us to budget in the short term, but also recognize that we may still need to rely on sustainable funding sources for long-term investment. And really, you know, with this, with the budget outlook significantly improving in all years, that we have a positive balance of $1.6 billion now projected for 2022 and 23, you know, it doesn't seem like that we would need to focus on any cuts. But with that, and in saying that, I would like to ask Commissioner Showalter to begin his presentation to the committee He has a team of members, but I will open up and would like to allow Commissioner Showalter to introduce himself for the record, and then also maybe do an introduction for his members and then begin.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me today is Dr. Laura Kalibakidis, our state economist, and Britta Raton, our state budget director. We have others in the audience as well. So if we get into additional detail, hopefully we can find the question, find the answer, or get there fast after the hearing. So, you know, what we're going to do is walk through the slide deck that we presented you on Friday. It just seems like forever ago. It was Friday, which gives you the up-to-date information regarding the economic budget forecast, including national economic information from our U.S. economic forecasters, IHS Market. Happy to take questions along the way, but certainly we'll have time for Q&A afterwards for sure. I just want to again thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the chance to walk through this, because you're absolutely right that, you know, the top line numbers are simple enough, but the message and the issues that are brought up by this forecast are complex, and actually paying attention to the specifics and understanding those things will help us all with better policymaking, better budgeting going forward. And before I go for any further, I just want to also just thank the team at MMB and other state agencies, because really that's where this information came from. We've got great economists, great budget people, great people in agencies looking at information on an ongoing basis that fed this forecast. And they've been working tirelessly for a long time, but particularly last month, to get this information in your hands. And that all of that information is on MMB's website at mn.gov/MMB. You can get the slides, you can get supplementary fund balances and all kinds of other information. So with that, Madam Chair, we'll get into the forecast.
Please proceed.
Okay. You know, my remarks on Friday, just to point out, it feels like we've been on a year-long roller coaster, you know, that we started going back last February, where there was a slide in there that mentioned this virus as an uncertainty with what was otherwise a really good forecast, with a projected surplus, low unemployment, continued economic growth. Obviously, the path dropped quickly from there, a lot of twists and surprises, uncertainty, going with the May forecast update, then again in the November, where we projected a more than $600 million surplus in the current biennium, but still had an anticipated $1 billion deficit going into the budget biennium that you're working on right now for fiscal years 22 and 23. The forecast here in February continues the good news from November. It is significantly better. With a $1.6 billion surplus or positive balance anticipated for fiscal years 22 and 23. This is directly related to information and improvement in our national economic outlook associated with federal pandemic relief that has emerged since the last forecast. The effect of that is to raise our revenue increase, our revenue projections, and decrease our anticipated state spending. We'll go into a little bit more information on both of those factors, because it's important to see how those play out. They aren't what you would normally expect in the midst of a recession. The issues here include the national impact and economic impact of stimulus bills and recovery bills. Are potential payments to states such as Minnesota, even as they're being debated in the U.S. Congress. So just note, you know, you see in the paper a $1.9 trillion package coming out of the House, possible direct state aid to Minnesota or other states. That direct aid is not part of this forecast. What is the impact of some portion of that going into the U.S. economy. Does this lead us to assume that we're all the way back? The answer is no. The state economy and budget isn't back to where we were last February when we started this. At this point, we're still running about $450 million behind where we were in last February's forecast. And this figure would be much, much worse if not for anticipated federal action. What you're also going to see is that there's an easy assumption that because the state budget is looking better, that must mean that household budgets are also looking better, and that's just not the case. While the relief package helps the economy and helps people particularly impacted by COVID-19 and the economic distress, the state budget picture masks the fact that the unemployment continues to be disproportionately impacting some sectors of our economy, and particularly lower wage workers in the state. And Dr. Kalamakidis will talk about that in her presentation. So let's just dig into the overall numbers. So next slide gives you the $1.6 billion projected balance in 2022-23. You'll see that the projected deficit is eliminated with a swing of about $2.45 billion since November. But how did we get to that $1.6 billion? It really is several pieces. The first is what's happening in this current biennium, in this current fiscal year, in this current biennium. We had some money, as I mentioned earlier, we are projecting some money on the bottom line in the current biennium. Some of that went away in special session, but bottom line is there was still some left over. And this forecast increases that by $546 million, leading us to have $940 million in the current biennium, assuming there's no other legislation affecting the current year. So we start with $940 million going into this biennium. This, if you're wondering, is this an unusually large change? The answer is yes, it is. We typically do not see such large swings at the end of a biennium. But then again, we typically don't see such large swings in federal fiscal policy between two forecasts either. The other pieces that get us to the projected surplus are improvements in revenue, about $1.4 billion, as you see in the chart, and $456 million less in projected spending. Finally, there's a small change in the stadium reserve. The next slide just gives you a kind of a schematic of how you get to that $1.6 billion and thinking about it a different way. $491 million is part of the transfer from the budget reserve to the general fund that you saw in the last forecast. That was part of the end of 2019 end of session budget negotiations. It's not new resources to the state. It's money moved from one pocket to another. Another part of the $1.6 billion is that carryover from the current fiscal year that I was just mentioning. So it's improvement in our current fiscal period that moves into and it helps improve the budget situation in the upcoming budget period. So 491 of the $1.6 billion is from the reserve, 940 is from the current biennium. So very little of the announced surplus actually is generated in 22 and 23. About $260 million is generated by projected revenues exceeding projected spending for the biennium. To make the math correct, there's one more piece. The actual change in reserve position is ultimately what we care about, and that includes $120 million in stadium reserve growth. And while that money lives in the general fund, there is a wall around these funds, and they're not available part of the
Madam Chair, did anyone else lose audio?
Commissioner, we lost a little bit of that conversation.
Oh, so,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you went mute on us. So.
Uh-oh, that's not good.
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, if we could just have the commissioner start from the very beginning and repeat everything, I think that would be, well, maybe not.
Well, be
not
better
from here again,
time.
Yeah.
So let's see, Madam Chair, could you still hear me while I was on the budget balance slide, this slide?
Yeah, could you start from here, from this
okay.
Space right here?
You bet. All right. So here's this slide gives you another way to look at the projected budget balance for 22 and 23. What you see here is about $491 million of the $1.6 billion is really due to a transfer that we talked about at the last forecast. That transfer from the budget reserve to the general fund was part of the 2019 end of session negotiations. It's not new money to the state. It's really money that was moved from one pocket to another. Another part of the $1.6 billion is carryover from the current fiscal year, current biennium that I discussed in the previous slide. So thinking about that $1.6 billion being the amount that's available in this budget biennium, just note that 491 of it is coming from the reserve and 940 of it's coming from the current biennium. So very little of the surplus is actually generated in fiscal years 22 and 23. $260 million to be exact is generated from projected revenues exceeding projected spending in the biennium. To make the math correct, there's one more piece. What we care about is the change in total reserves, and that includes $120 million in stadium reserve growth. That money lives in the general fund, but current law is built well around those funds, and so they're not part of the available balance. You put those pieces together, you'll see that there's a budget anticipated budget balance in 22 and 23. But as your CFO, it's just important to note that a bulk of this money is coming from one-time resources. So hopefully my audio kept on going through that because it's a really important point, and it's context, I think, as we go through the rest of the presentation. But with that, Madam Chair, members, I'll turn it over to, if there's not any direct questions right now, I'll turn it over to Dr. Kalavakidis. We'll talk about our economic outlook.
Members, do you have any questions?
Madam Chair, if I could just recommend that we perhaps hold questions until the presentation is completed, but I do have questions later on for Commissioner Schulman.
We have a few questions. All right. So why don't we move forward with the next testifier. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Laura Kalumbakidis, Minnesota State Economist. I'm going to start with the U.S. outlook and how that has changed since November. I'm going to talk about Minnesota's economy and then turn to details of our new revenue forecast. In the chart you have in front of you, the height of the bars shows annual U.S. real GDP growth. The blue bars show the history and the February forecast by our consulting firm, IHS. The green bars show IHS's November forecast. So that's the previous one, the one that informed our November forecast. In the history, so looking back to the left-hand side of the chart, you can see the economic contraction or the decline in real GDP that occurred during the last recession when GDP fell 0.1% in 2008 and 2.5% in 2009. And then you can see the 10 years of growth that followed. There's some variation in those growth rates, but it was relatively moderate, relatively steady growth for 10 years. Now look at the right-hand side of the chart. You can see how things abruptly changed in February of 2020. IHS now estimates that real GDP declined 3.5% in 2020 with annual growth returning this year. Their expectation is it returns this year at 5.7% before decelerating to 4.1% next year. And then it grows an average of 2.5% annually throughout the remainder of our forecast period. With this outlook, IHS expects real GDP to regain its pre-pandemic peak this year, but the economic recovery has been uneven and is expected to be uneven, so that GDP associated with production of goods has already reached its pre-pandemic level, and the service sector is not expected to fully recover until a significant portion of the U.S. population is vaccinated against COVID-19. The current forecast for 21 real GDP growth is 2.6 percentage points higher than the prior forecast. So the difference from 3.1%, which is what informed our November forecast, to 5.7% now. That is a large forecast change to see between November and February. The primary reason for the change is the inclusion in the February forecast of the impact on the U.S. economy of two significant rounds of federal pandemic relief that were not reflected in the November forecast. First is the $900 billion package that Congress passed at the end of last year. And second is $1.5 trillion of additional federal relief from a bill that Congress is considering now and that IHS expects to be enacted by mid-March. So the bill that you're hearing about in Congress, I think, has a price tag of $1.9 trillion in Congress. IHS is assuming $1.5 trillion of that money gets enacted by mid-March, and that starts affecting the U.S. economic growth in the second quarter of this year. So the economic impact of these two federal measures is baked into our economic forecast, even while, as the commissioner said, any direct payments to state and local governments that arise from the anticipated federal legislation is not. Despite the improvement in the outlook, the U.S. forecast remains volatile, it remains uncertain, and it depends critically on the path of the pandemic. In this forecast, IHS assumes that the rate of COVID-19 infections continues to recede following last month's peak. So they expect the peak will have been January of 2021, and that the rate of infections is going to continue to recede from that point. IHS now expects widespread effective vaccination of the U.S. population will be achieved by the fall. The next chart shows the forecast change in real consumer spending growth. So consumer spending accounts for two-thirds of real GDP. So I often focus on the consumer spending outlook in these presentations because changes in consumer spending have big effects on the U.S. outlook in general. In addition, increases in the forecast for U.S. real consumer spending affect our forecast for Minnesota consumer sales taxes. The additional federal stimulus and an improving COVID-19 situation have prompted IHS to raise their forecast for real consumer spending in both 21 and 22. After a decline of 3.9% in 2020, IHS expects spending to grow 6% in 21, an increase of 2.4 percentage points from their November forecast. They forecast 3% average annual growth from 23 to 25. Based on evidence that IHS looked at and that others have analyzed, that the 2020 fiscal stimulus, the stimulus payments and the supplemental unemployment insurance benefits that occurred in calendar year 2020, those payments boosted consumer spending, but they also led to a spike in consumer saving. So we had a very high personal saving rate in the United States last year. Based on that evidence, IHS assumes that not all of the stimulus that's coming is spent, that they assume is coming, is spent in 21. Not all of it is spent this year, and some is available to support spending in 22. Now I'll move to Minnesota's economy. The pandemic-induced economic downturn that began last year brought severe disruptions to Minnesota's economy. During 2020, the state experienced job losses, wage losses, a reduced labor force, shifts in consumer spending patterns. In this forecast, an improved outlook for U.S. economic growth in 21 and 22 that is supported by federal pandemic relief spending drives our expectation that Minnesota's job and wage losses of last year will be followed by positive employment and wage growth through our forecast period. The chart you have in front of you compares Minnesota's labor market to the nation's via the overall unemployment rate. The light line is the U.S. unemployment rate, and the blue line is Minnesota's. Minnesota's unemployment rate has fallen since its peak of 9.9% in May of last year. In December, which is the last data point we have for the unemployment rate in Minnesota, in December, the state unemployment rate fell to 4.4%, down from 4.5% in November, and well below the U.S. rate of 6.7%, which is what the U.S. rate was in December. However, that lower unemployment rate doesn't tell the full labor market story. In December, the decline in the unemployment rate was the result of a reduction in the labor force, rather than from unemployed job seekers finding work. Since the onset of the pandemic, Minnesota's labor force has fallen by 102,000 people. And we have 35,000 more people unemployed and looking for work than we did last February. Over the last year, Minnesota lost 248,000 jobs, with the largest gaps in industries most affected by social distancing and containment measures, particularly, of course, those face-to-face interpersonal interaction service sectors. Between February and December of 2020, Minnesota's leisure and hospitality sector lost 123,000 jobs. That was 44% of that sector's February 2020 employment. These job losses have disproportionately impacted low-income workers. Workers in that sector earn 46% less per hour on average than people in the private sector as a whole earn. Moving to our forecast for Minnesota, in the next chart, we show the annual growth rate in total Minnesota wage and salary income. So these are all the payroll disbursements of all the employers in the state of Minnesota, and the height of the bars shows the growth rates in that measure. The blue bars, again, show the history in our current forecast, and the green bars show our November forecast. Again, you can see that dramatic decline in total wage income that occurred in the previous recession, 4.8% decline in Minnesota wage and salary disbursements. We're now forecasting a decline of 0.6% this year. That's a smaller decline than what we expected in November. And then we expect moderate growth, averaging 5% annually thereafter. The relatively small decline in wage income, that 0.6%, I mean, it's a decline, so it's important, but it's small relative to the one we saw in the previous recession. That relatively small decline, when the unemployment rate peaked at such a high level, arises because unemployment in this economic downturn has disproportionately impacted lower wage workers. We know, for example, that a large share of unemployment insurance benefits claimants were people from lower wage occupations. So the wage decline is smaller than it would have been if unemployment had been more broadly distributed across sectors and across jobs. Turning to our new revenue forecast. In the revenue forecast table, the first two columns of the table show the current forecast and the forecast change for the current biennium, fiscal years 20 and 21. And the next two columns show the same for the next biennium. Total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $463 million more than the November forecast. The income tax forecast is lower than in November, and the forecasts for the other major taxes have all been raised. Individual income tax receipts are now forecast to be $100 million less than the prior forecast. We have a lower estimate for tax liability in tax year 19, which is the base year for our forecasting, our income tax forecast. And then we have other forecast adjustments that lowered the income tax forecast for the remainder of this fiscal year. Sales tax revenue is now forecast to be $77 million more than the prior forecast. That's consistent with that increased consumer spending growth, forecast consumer spending growth that I showed you earlier. And it's also due to higher sales tax collections so far this fiscal year. The corporate tax is a similar story. It's projected to generate $238 million more than the prior forecast based on higher collections so far this fiscal year and higher forecast growth for corporate profits in calendar year 21. The current forecast for total revenues for the next biennium is $1.423 billion higher than the prior forecast, and the forecasts for all major tax types have been increased. And it's important to remember that fiscal years 22 and 23 are the years in which most of the positive impacts of those assumed federal fiscal payments will hit both the income tax and the sales tax for Minnesota. So for the income tax, the higher forecast is primarily due to higher expected wage income and also higher expected non-wage income. The sales tax forecast benefits from a higher starting point from the higher current biennium forecast and then higher, faster expected growth in taxable sales. Moving to the next chart, the extraordinary volatility and uncertainty in the economy in the last year, that volatility and uncertainty that volatility you saw in that real GDP chart that showed 10 years of fairly steady growth followed by a 3.5% decline and then 5.7% growth, that kind of volatility and uncertainty that arose from the pandemic, from the economic downturn, and significant infusions of federal fiscal support, that's driven large changes in our economic and revenue forecasts. But as the commissioner said, we're not back to where we thought we were 1 year ago with regard to the revenue forecast. In this chart, the height of the bars shows our revenue forecasts for the current biennium on the left and the next biennium on the right. The blue bars show today's forecasts, and the green bars show our forecasts of 1 year ago. So this is different from our usual forecast comparison chart. Usually we're comparing just to the last forecast, which in this case would be November. But this time, thought it would be useful to show you where we were a whole year ago. The distance between the height of the bars shows how far we are from where we thought that biennium was going to be a year ago. Our revenue forecast for the current biennium is $1.2 billion below what we forecast in February of 2020. For FY22 and 23, our forecast remains $461 million short of where it was in February. So let me close by reiterating some of the many risks to this forecast. I've mentioned that the economic forecast depends critically on the path of the pandemic and the timing of when we achieve widespread effective vaccination of the population. The full economic impacts of the $900 billion in federal relief that was enacted at the end of last year still remain uncertain. Some of that appears to be known, but some of it is not known yet. And the additional $1.5 trillion assumed in this forecast has not yet passed both houses of Congress. There is uncertainty about when consumers will feel safe enough to return to more normal level of spending on services in particular. So when we're going to revert to more normal spending patterns, and about how much of the expected federal fiscal stimulus payments they will spend and how much of it they'll save. This forecast depends on business owners having enough confidence in the recovery to continue investing in their businesses. Any setback in business investment would slow growth. During the recovery, consumer spending is expected to be supported by those federal relief payments, but it's also expected to be supported by improvements in household wealth from rising home and equity prices. A significant decline in household wealth, for instance, from a correction in equity prices, would create a negative wealth effect that would slow growth below forecasted rates. And finally, with 28 months remaining until the end of the next biennium, none of the revenues that we're forecasting for FY 22 and 23 have been collected yet. Even small changes in assumed growth rates and important revenue sources can have big changes in the outlook for this biennium and the next. If we're holding questions until the end, then I'll now turn it over to State Budget Director Bridget Raitan.
Yes, thank you so much. To the director, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Britta Raitan, State Budget Director with MMB. And with this next slide, we're turning to the expenditure side of the forecast. And this slide is showing the change in both the current biennium with this forecast and in the biennium FY 22 and 23. So the actual for projection for 2021 and the change is reflected on the left-hand side, and 22 and 23 is reflected on the right-hand side. So overall projected spending in the current biennium is down by $83 million relative to our prior estimates. The change in the upcoming biennium, 22 and 23, is a reduction of $456 million relative to our prior projections. As you can see on the chart, E12 spending estimates are down $39 million in the current biennium when compared to what we were projecting in November, and $165 million in 22 and 23. There are two significant reasons for the change across these 4 years. In 2021, the change is due to lower pupil projections. The impact of the lower student counts was reflected in our November forecast, but since that time, actual data has shown further decline than we previously forecast, with families delaying kindergarten enrollment or opting for private school options or opting to homeschool their students. In total, the student count in this forecast decreased by approximately 4,000 students relative to our November projection for the current school year. And when compared to our February forecast a year ago for this current school year, our student count has been reduced by almost 16,700 students. In FY22-23, the reduced student counts continue to contribute to the downward change, but a reduction in compensatory aid accounts for the largest portion of the reduction. Compensatory funding is generated based on free and reduced lunch counts. In the next biennium, it's reduced by $113 million from our previous projections. And the aid for next year is based on the number of students that are qualifying for free and reduced lunch in the current school year. So it's lagged a year. So next year's aid is based on the experience in this school year. And due to remote learning, changes in federal meal reimbursement requirements, and fewer families actually applying for free and reduced lunch, this reduces the number of students that are used in that calculation to generate the aid payments for the upcoming school year. This slide is also showing a decrease relative to our prior forecast in the Health and Human Services spending projections. The HHS expenditure forecast is down $54 million in 2021 and $257 million in 2022-23 when compared to our prior estimates. A significant portion of the change in the current biennium, or $35 million of the change, is due to reduced utilization of the Child Care Assistance Program in the current year. The change in FY22-23 is primarily due to the assumption that the federal public health emergency will continue through the end of this calendar year. And as that federal public health emergency continues, that means that the state would continue to receive increased federal support for medical assistance. And the federal match during the federal public health emergency is increased by 6.2 percentage points. So this essentially lowers the state share of medical assistance by $305 million in the 22-23 biennium compared to our previous estimates. So previously, we had assumed that the federal public health emergency would continue through the end of June in this current year. With this updated projection, we are adding an additional 6 months, or the first 6 months of fiscal year 22. The reason we made that change is we did receive a letter from the federal government providing us with information that the intent was to continue this emergency declaration through the calendar year, which made us make this change in our assumption. Turning to the next slide, this slide is similar to the slide Dr. Kolombokidis walked you through, comparing the projected spending in this February forecast to the projections from our February forecast 1 year ago. And that was before we knew the full impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as you can see on the chart, our spending projections have decreased across the four-year period from FY 2020 through the end of FY 22-23 by nearly $1.8 billion. And these spending reductions are largely a direct result of the pandemic. The largest piece of that spending change is due to the increased federal support for medical assistance that I just mentioned. It was not included in our forecast 1 year ago. And with this forecast, we're now recognizing that this would continue for two full calendar years. So essentially the full calendar year 2020, the full calendar year 2021. And so overall, since our previous projections a year ago in February, this support has offset state spending by approximately $1.2 billion. The other significant component of the change since last February is the reduced spending in E-12 education that I just talked about. Again, this is due to changes largely brought on by the pandemic, with fewer students in our public schools than were previously projected. Changes in E-12 education spending have resulted in nearly $500 million in reduced projected spending over this time horizon when compared to the projections we made 1 year ago. So if you turn to the next slide, with this slide, we return to a view of the total revenues and expenditures in the general fund. And this slide is showing the upcoming 22-23 biennium, as well as providing a look at the planning estimates for 24 and 25. And what this slide is looking at is structural balance in the next two biennia, which means we're just comparing the projected revenues to projected expenditures in each biennium. And so that is taking out of the calculation the impact of dollars carrying forward from a prior biennium or the changes in the reserves. So you can see here the structural balance in 22-23 totals $260 million. And this number is consistent with Commissioner Showalter walked you through early on in the presentation. But in another positive piece of news, the structural balance is projected to grow in FY24 and 25 to $845 million. And that's because the revenue estimates with this forecast are growing at a faster rate than the expenditure estimates. Now, of course, this is base level spending, but it is growing. The revenue estimates are growing at a faster rate, and you can see that in the annualized growth section of the slide. And then finally, we do include an estimate of inflation on this slide for the next two biennia. And this is to give a sense of the cost pressures that exist into the next biennium and into the tails. As you know, inflation is generally not included in the spending side of our estimates, except in areas where there's a formula that's based on actual cost or where there's an inflationary factor built into the formula. So this estimate of inflation is just applying a CPI level of inflation to all of the other spending areas that don't have some inflationary or cost-based component to the formula. And with that, Madam Chair, I can pass it back to the Commissioner to give some closing comments before we take questions.
Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I just appreciate the chance to walk through this forecast. And obviously, this is really good news. We have gone through a lot of changes and a lot of changed assumptions and uncertainty over the past year. Going into this budget, we're in better shape, both in the current budget period as well as the one that we're moving into. But obviously, there's a lot of work still to be done because this doesn't give us enough certainty or clarity to understand where we're, all the choices that are still ahead of us, and we're going to start to make some smart decisions. Those are the kinds of smart decisions that have gotten to this place where we built up the budget reserve, where we were able to see our way through the last year of volatility, is still able to help us.
Our commissioner has frozen on us. Give him a moment.
Madam Chair, while he's frozen, we could also go to questions if you'd prefer. Oh, he looks like maybe he's back.
Oh, and I phased off. Closing, I was, happy to take any questions, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. So why don't we go and move forward with the questions with Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Commissioner, as always, thank you to you and your staff for your presentation. I'll try to be brief here. Commissioner, in the presentation, we discussed how there's the potential for what looks to be an almost $2 trillion package passed by the federal government. There are published reports that the state of Minnesota could be receiving up to $5 billion in direct aid to the states. What approval does the legislature need to give to allocate those funds?
Madam Chair, Representative, great questions. Right now, I think the level of direct state spending or state and local spending is pretty variable, and we'll see what they base that allocation on. A couple of the key questions are whether they're going to be taking it off of lost revenue or the impact on individuals, such as through a marker of unemployment insurance claims. You're right, is that we're going to figure that all out, and a lot of it is the timing. The committee and the committee staff are expert at, there's current law talks about how federal funds are going to be recognized. There's the normal process, which ideally we would know exactly where we're at today. We could submit it to the legislature with any kind of supplemental changes that go with this forecast, and it would be part of that budget process. Failing that, we would have to do it after, I think it's like middle, late March. We would submit it for review, but at that point it goes under a different LAC process, but all of those ultimately are part of the discussion and review process of the legislature and the governor to get the information and understand the specifics and how they work with the legislative budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. So you guys, you don't need the legislature's approval to appropriate that money then?
Commissioner Sherwood.
I wouldn't put it that way. I think the key thing here is there's processes that have been in place because we're always thinking that we're doing something that's totally novel, when the fact of the matter is the legislature and the governor have faced these kinds of situations before. We're going to end up submitting it to the legislature for your review and approval one way or another. Well, the first thing we need to do is find out what's in that package and understand what are the choices and what are the kinds of allocations and strings that go with this federal money.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And so, Commissioner, the FMAP money, the extension of that for additional 6 months, there seems to be something that you clarified during your budget forecast, and there seems to be some members of the legislature who are under the false impression that the governor needs to retain his supreme powers for us to be eligible for that FMAP expansion or the higher reimbursement rate. Can you just clarify for members and inform members the fact that there's no requirement that the governor has those executive powers in order for us to get the higher qualified FMAP?
Commissioner Showalter.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, great question point. Yes, as discussed on Friday, the continuation of the enhanced FMAP that's included in the forecast is based upon a federal letter, a letter that was received and distributed to all 50 states, talking about the availability expectations of the federal government that their emergency declaration would continue for the current calendar year. It does not rely on any state-level declarations of authority or emergency status. So Minnesota's decisions, its status as far as an emergency setting does not impact that enhanced FMAP. It's only whether the federal government continues its declaration.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And then for Dr. Cole Nikitas, my final question, if she is still available.
Dr. Colonna Peters. Representative, yeah. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for your thorough presentation. So one of the things that was done in federal policy last year was the expansion of UI benefits for a higher reimbursement rate, a higher compensation rate. It was $600 more. Under Minnesota state law, that $600, as well as the unemployment insurance benefits, are those currently subject to state income taxes?
Dr. Kololoukis.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, they are.
Okay. And so, Madam Chair, we're talking about the one-time nature of things. I think that'd be something that we should be working with the administration on, is making sure that those people at the, as was highlighted in the presentation, that those at the bottom of the economic ladder suffered the most economic distress. Mm-hmm. It would seem that a targeted way to provide financial assistance would be to, on a temporarily basis, exclude those dollars from taxes, that just those who are who collected unemployment on a temporary basis would have their unemployment compensation excluded from taxes. We have the resources to do that, to make sure that the PPP loans aren't taxed. So I would hope that we could work together on that and not wait till the end of session. But again, Commissioner and staff, I appreciate your presentation and look forward to working with you guys the rest of the session. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. So we have Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the MMB team for being here. I have two, three questions. I'll try to be very quick. For Commissioner Showalter, I guess, just looking at this, the one sentence that jumps to mind for me is good news with caveats. And I think you said as much when you started us off. I was looking at the long-term budget outlook part of this, and it was music to my ears to hear revenue estimates growing faster than expenditures. I think that's good news. I think it's good news because it for me, it tells me that there's room for really smart, responsible planning on our part as a state. And I think it's one of the things that we do well in this state. And so I have two quick questions. On the long-term budget outlook, I assume that long-term look is independent of current historic levels of federal revenue. Am I correct on that? Because obviously we're in a weird period, not weird, but we're in a different period now. But I think the long-term budget look is probably just sort of going back to some kind of evened out ongoing federal revenue scenario. Is that correct?
Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. So as an example, the assumption of enhanced FMAP, an increased federal share for our Medicaid program ceases after the calendar year and goes back to the traditional or historic levels after that. So same thing is true on the revenue side, where we're anticipating sort of the national forecaster and their assumptions of federal economic activity and how that affects the national economy.
Mm. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I guess this next question, I think it's for Ms. Rattan. There's something that perked up for me when we looked at, when you shared the information on student enrollments. with 16,700 less students. But the part that really pricked up or got my ears to really pay closer attention was the compensatory aid portion being less this year. And to me, that sounds counterintuitive in this period of time, you know, with high unemployment, you know, a lot of folks economically struggling, you know, at the individual family level. And so what I hear is that there's less low-income kids in our system, and that just kind of doesn't make sense to me. But can you maybe just say a little bit more about that?
Director Rachel.
Certainly, Representative Mariani and Madam Chair. I mean, it's really a function of how the formula works, that it is the aid for next year is based on the count of free and reduced lunch eligible students in the current year. And to be in that count, there needs to be a free and reduced lunch application or form filled out. And so in some ways, it's a function of the pandemic, we think, in the way the formula functions in statute.
Representative Mariani.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Rattan, so people aren't filling out the form? Is that?
Representative Mariani, I think that is a component of it. I would defer to MDE to go into more depth, but I think that's a component is yes, that there is less, fewer families filing for free and reduced lunch eligibility. And I think part of that is also the federal access to meals at this point in time during the pandemic makes it less imperative that families do fill out the form. But then that affects our count as a state.
Thank you. Ms. Rattan, I probably will follow up with the department. Yeah. And then, Madam Chair, just the final, and I actually will do this as a question because I don't want to eat up the time, but just a quick comment. You know, we're looking at this exercise is for the sake of us making, you know, decisions in the next several weeks, you know, for the next biennium. And so, you know, so we're looking at the forecast, but we also know that that forecast exists within a long-term, you know, trend, if you will, or patterns that are going to be unfolding here. Before us, I think there's going to be, you know, volatility with that, and that's probably that caveat part of that, the good news. One of the things I want to remind myself and my colleagues is that when it comes to issues of volatility, I would argue that one of the things that, and this is going to be hard for us to pin down, it probably takes longer periods of time to pin it down, but, you know, some of the volatile issues I think we have are things like an aging workforce. We have huge educational disparities among our fastest growing student populations, i.e. our students of color, indigenous students. And so their ability to be able to be equipped, to be able to fill that workforce in a short period of time, I think is incredibly challenging for us. And then there's immigration issues and whether or not there'll be a flow of immigration into the state, either from other states and or from other parts of the world. Those are all pretty volatile elements, but it seems to me that one of the things we have to constantly do is to be able to work on those issues to be able to maximize the economic impact on us. And you know, perhaps the really quick question is, how big, and this is, I suppose, to the commissioner, how big are any of those relative to impactful dynamics in our state budget? Or, you know, are they important social issues, but, you know, we're going to be economically fine even if we ignore those issues, not going to change any of these long-term numbers.
Commissioner Showalter?
I'm not quite sure. I want to check whether Dr. K has any perspective on that.
Okay. Who can respond to the Representative Mariani question?
I will.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, so you have identified several of the important initial conditions, as we say in economics. So where did you start? You know, what was your starting point before this event happened? So some of our initial conditions having to do with disparities, having to do with the aging workforce, you know, it wasn't that long ago that those were the things we were talking about in the budget forecast. And then this big event happened. And so there is no reason to think that those issues, those challenges are going to disappear because this volatile event occurred. So when the dust settles, then those things will be back on our radar screen. You know, the workforce is going to continue to age. There still will be uncertainty about how much international immigration is coming in. But I can also say that the pandemic and the very abrupt economic downturn and then the very large infusions of money from the federal government, these are disrupting kinds of events. And so there are lots of sectors of the economy that are being disrupted right now, and we actually don't know where they're going to land. So the conditions that you talked about, those still remain issues that need to be dealt with, need to be considered. And then there will be other things too, once the pandemic is over, that we can't foresee at the moment.
Thank you, Dr. Kolomoukidis, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have several things. So as I was analyzing this and reading it and comparing it to other things, one thing that really jumped out at me was this really large percentage growth of GDP. So the real GDP for 2021, it's an 84% increase. So all the way up to 5.7%. Now, CBO is only projecting for 2021, 3.7%. So 5.7% compared to 3.7% is a huge increase. Again, that's an 84% increase over the November projection of 3.1. Just to put that in perspective, if you look at GDP growth since 1990, so longer than my oldest son has even been alive, I haven't seen anything even close to that except for maybe 1999, and that was a 4.8% GDP growth. And I understand we've got a pandemic and all of that, but just from the November 2020 to the February forecast is an 84% increase. That's just unbelievable. And I realize that these aren't really your numbers. You have a consultant, IHS is your consultant, but it just seems out of step, let's just say. I'm wondering if you could address that. Also, I have another concern. So you talked about business investment. You said that if we had a decrease in business investment, it would slow economic growth. So you're basically saying if we see a reduction in capital expenditures, then we're going to see a slower economic growth. So coupled with this really high projection of GDP, again, 84% increase over your previous projections, and realizing that the governor continues to talk about taxing businesses. So that would be, if we did that, if we taxed businesses even higher, that would be a direct result. The direct result of that would be slower economic growth. Those were your words. You said a decrease in business investment, i.e. a decrease in capital expenditures, would slow economic growth. So, and yet the governor continues to want to tax businesses even more, which would continue to slow growth. So I have a concern about that. And then I have an even bigger concern.
I don't know if you can follow, but why don't we pause for a moment, Representative O'Neill, and see can Commissioner Showalter answer the first two questions.
All right. I have more after that.
Yeah. Sure. Commissioner Showalter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll start to answer and invite Dr. Kolomoukidis to jump in as well. As far as the growth in GDP, you're absolutely right. This is unusual change of an events. And as I mentioned in my comments, the changes between November and February are unusual and really tied to two different federal actions and rescue bills that have been enacted. One has been enacted, one is being considered by the Congress, and are included in our national economic forecast. So between those two bills, we're looking at about $2.4 trillion of potential stimulus coming into the bill, into the economy. That said, I don't understand the 84% growth figure that you're talking about, and was trying to pull up my, for us to pull up the GDP numbers. But you're absolutely right in terms of that this is a market change. And part of that is, you know, that management perspective that we all have to take of these are unusual times. There are unusual things going on. And so paying attention to the specifics is really important. And we'll talk about the GDP growth in a sec. But ultimately, you know, what we're seeing is a swing closer to where we were about a year ago, but we're not quite there. So in terms of the revenues that we had originally anticipated, even with the changes and the federal rescue plans that are out there, the bottom line is we're still in state revenues below where we were anticipating about a year ago. As far as the economic and GDP growth, I would turn it over to Dr. Kellen Kitas just to comment about that and some of the discussion with the Council of Economic Advisors.
Dr. Kellen Kitas?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, the IHS is forecasting 5.7% GDP growth as the for this year. As the commissioner mentioned, that is the forecast change from November to February is because of these two changes in federal fiscal payments that were not assumed in the November outlook. The CBO projection was released prior to there being an assumption of additional federal fiscal stimulus. So that's the reason CBO is lower. We don't know what CBO thinks it would be with this bill that is before Congress right now. What we do with the U.S. economic outlook is that we, of course, evaluated ourselves. We look at the history of what IHS has forecast. We look how it, we see how it looks compared to what other forecasters are doing. And then we have an independent Council of Economic Advisors who review the U.S. economic outlook twice before each forecast. And so in this case, they reviewed IHS's January outlook and then their February outlook. And their statement is included in our book. They agreed that there is tremendous volatility in the economy right now, but they agreed that IHS's outlook was a reasonable starting point for Minnesota's economic forecast. They noted some of the risks that are included on among the risks that I mentioned to you. And that's their role, is to assess the U.S. outlook and assess those risks for us so that we understand what risks we are taking on by accepting IHS's baseline outlook. In November, if I remember correctly, they were concerned that there wasn't additional fiscal stimulus in IHS's forecast at that time, and they thought that the possibility of additional fiscal stimulus created upside potential to the forecast. By the time we got to February, that fiscal stimulus had been added. It's not to say that there's no risk to this. These are risky and uncertain times, and yes, that is it's high expected growth going forward. Regarding the relative to history, these are, as the commissioner said, these are very unusual times, and this is a big infusion of federal cash into the economy. Regarding the business investment question, so business investment in capital in equipment, in structures, in intellectual property, that forms about 17% of GDP. I said earlier that consumer spending is about 2/3 of GDP. So it's an important component of GDP, and movements in business capital investment in the U.S. can move GDP and can move GDP growth. In addition, capital investment can change. If the investment is in productivity-enhancing equipment, it can change productivity going forward. And so the outlook, IHS's outlook, assumes that across the U.S., in the U.S. economy, that business confidence in the economic recovery stays strong enough that businesses will continue to invest in that equipment, those structures, and that intellectual property, and that will continue, that will support the level of growth that they're expecting. One of the big pieces there is that they have an expectation of improved or higher prices for crude oil. And at the U.S. level, when oil prices go up, that tends to stimulate exploration and drilling activity in oil-producing states. And so that investment in structures number tends to move, tends to be highly correlated with oil prices. And so that's not something that affects Minnesota. We're not an oil-producing state. But in their outlook, some of that business investment activity is in structure, in mining and drilling structures, because of oil changes in the oil price.
Representative Neer, I understand that you have a few more questions to ask, but I have four hands up, so I'm hoping that you can find the most important one that you need to ask now. And if we have time, we'll come back after the other four representatives.
Madam Chair, well, actually, the three actually tied together, which is why I was just continuing my line of questioning. Normally, I'd ask a question and let them respond, but my third and final point actually all ties together, which will make it'll be completely clear when I point that out. So my concern is inflation. So you were just talking about how these two large stimulus packages coming from the federal government, $900 billion and one, which was authorized in December, which still has not been released into the economy, by the way. So we haven't seen the impact of that at all. And potential a $1.5 or $1.9 trillion stimulus package from the federal government in March. So in my reading and in my studying of this, there is a huge concern on the other side of this, which is inflation. Because if we stimulate the economy too much, what happens? You have high demand, higher prices, i.e. inflation. And so I didn't really hear anything in the presentation about the flip side of all this federal investment or federal stimulus money or whatever we call the federal package, which is driving up inflation. And so I know that has got to be a concern, and I'm not sure if that's factored into anything. I didn't hear that, and I didn't read anything about the IHS's estimation about the effect of inflation that could be coming because of these two packages being passed or potentially being passed. And the other aspect of that, which you did touch on, is the job participation rate, which is really low for Minnesota. It's continuing to plummet as people just give up even looking, or they're just satisfied with the unemployment insurance that they're getting. I'm not sure which side of the coin that is. Maybe it's the same side of a coin. But can you just address the concerns coming about these huge stimulus packages and the effect of inflation and how that affects both the economic growth and also future forecasts, and then the tie into the really low job participation that's happening right now because of the factors that you just mentioned. Thank you.
Commissioner Showalter, quickly.
Sure. Madam Chair, I'll give it a shot, but Dr. Kalambakidis, happy to have you join in. The forecast, I'm just going to use this as a plug because there's a lot of data inside the roughly 100-page forecast document. So representative, your questions, really good ones. There are detailed tables about the inflation assumptions, the GDP deflators, how these affects employment, all within the book itself. And so those are regular features. And for example, on your CPI question, absolutely, that was something that IHS Market was looking at, our council and our economists are looking at. Right now, the estimates are around 2%. Based upon the data that we have for the GDP CPI increases over this period. The question about macroeconomics, I'm going to defer to our state economist, But, you know, the bottom line here is that, you know, the employment, the CPI, all of these things are interrelated. And that's part of the reason we do this detailed look with professionals to be able to balance all of these competing factors, because I think it's easy to sort of worry about one thing and the other, and we worry about them all. But at the bottom line is we've got to come out and give you something that you can manage with and a point of view and hopefully some professionally grounded information that you can use to make decisions on really difficult public policy choices that are still ahead. And that's why I'm happy to turn it over to Dr. Kamala Bakides, because, you know, she's a professor at the University of Minnesota, has other really well-trained individuals working for her and are able to take a lot of expertise into these topics.
Dr. Kamala Bakides, please.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative, inflation, well, before I start on the inflation question, I just want to clarify something about the CBO forecast, and that is that the Congressional Budget Office by law does a current federal law forecast, so they can't incorporate into their economic forecast federal law changes that are anticipated, whereas the private forecasting companies are in the business of trying to anticipate what is going to happen. So that's why that's taken into consideration by the private forecasting companies and not by the Congressional Budget Office. There are conversations about inflation going on out there. This is a big, it's a sizable stimulus, but it is a sizable stimulus that is taking place at a time when there is significant labor market slack, meaning there are people who are unemployed, there are people who are on the bench in the labor market. And the Fed has changed the way they talk about inflation and their guidance, their forward-looking guidance on inflation. So part of that is because of the 10 years of economic growth that I showed you in that real GDP chart, where we were perpetually during those years wondering when is inflation going to happen, since we have this long period of growth, and inflation stayed subdued. And the Fed has learned from that, and many economists are reassessing their expectations for inflation based on that. And the Fed is now saying that while they do still have a rough target for where they want inflation to be, they do believe that there is labor market slack. So that means that they are willing to let inflation stay at or above their target for a longer period than they used to in the past in order to get closer to maximum employment. So inflation in the forecast, as the commissioner said, it's considered in the forecast, it's listed in the book. It is more subdued than you might have expected had you had this kind of stimulus prior to the Great Recession. But the lessons learned since the Great Recession have shown us that the Fed is willing to let the economy, quote, run hot potentially, in order to draw more workers into the economy. In addition to that, IHS assumes that long-term inflation expectations, which is what people think inflation's going to be, those long-term inflation expectations remain anchored at around 2%. And so that's one of the determinants of inflation, is what people think it's going to be. So they're estimating that it's remaining anchored at around 2%. And so it's okay to expect for them to expect inflation to remain around 2%. Another issue that is going on here is that the increase in the value of the dollar lowers prices of imports, raises the price of our exports, lowers prices of imports, and that puts downward pressure on inflation, even as the economy is growing. And then finally, between their January forecast and their February forecast, IHS changed the point at which they expect Fed monetary policy, quote, liftoff, with a point at which the Fed will start raising interest rates. And they moved it from 2026 back to 2024. And one of the reasons for that is that it prevents unemployment from going so low as to stimulate inflation. And so it keeps the inflation forecast more moderate going forward as well.
Clearly, it's very complicated with many factors and assumptions and changes happening all at the same time. We're going to move on to Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Moran, and thank you, Commissioner, and your team. Great job, as always. My question, you mentioned the sales tax and the sales tax increases. When could we see the final number that like the special funds will work with, like the legacy fund? If you could have that pretty soon to us and then send that to Chair Moran and myself, and obviously Senator Rubin her team, but as soon as we could get it, could you give us an idea when we might see that?
Is that Dr.
Thank you.
Peters, can you guys make sure we get that information? Commissioner?
Representative Moran, we can get that to you as soon as possible, yes.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Knorr, and then Petersburg, the DeMarc Court.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Thank you to Commissioner Schultz and Dr. Kalambukidis and Director Ritan, always for the analysis and information that you shared with us. And thank you for highlighting the impact of the economic fallout impacting low-income workers. And it shows that we've got to do more work to ensure that we support their families. At the same time, I just wanted to ask a quick question in regards to that. The president at the federal level signed executive orders, including FEMA 100% reimbursement. I know we haven't allocated any resources, such as a food relief program, so that we can support those who are in food insecurity. Mm-hmm. Can we really tackle those issues through state agencies, or do we have to allocate funding so that we can take advantage of the 100% FEMA reimbursement that we have through the executive orders that were recently signed? And some of that will be expiring by September, so we are not doing what is necessary to support the families who are struggling today.
Commissioner Show Walters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, great question. You're pointing out a couple of different things. One is our response to the needs of Minnesotans related to the pandemic. Just going back in time, you know, I was around for the Great Recession, and the impacts of that you could see on all different parts of the economic income scale. The concentrated impact of this recession is markedly different, and it's easy to sort of see this national or the GDP number and not realize how concentrated it is. The state has already put out a number of federal dollars for different purposes related to the CARES Act, and those are the types of expenditures along with the state expenditures that are related to that FEMA reimbursement. In this forecast, just for background, there is a special sort of discussion about FEMA reimbursement and opportunities that the state is already using and helping that show up in this budget forecast. So there's about $100 million that's coming back into the state as a result of much clearer cooperation and higher reimbursement levels for FEMA. That's helping some of the budget numbers that we've already presented. And beyond that is, obviously, you know, it's what is the direction, what are the opportunities that we get from any, you know, additional congressional actions, because I'm anticipating some of those dollars will have flexible opportunities for the state to decide what we want to target those monies to. Budget Director Ray Khan is deeply enmeshed in the federal funds activity. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Britta.
Director Rader?
I would just, Representative Knorr and Moran, I would just highlight that we are at this point assessing all of the early state investments that were made with general fund dollars to make sure we are pursuing FEMA wherever possible. There is a lag with when we can actually go to FEMA for reimbursement because the funds have to actually have been expended in most cases before we can put in an application to FEMA. But right now we are working with DHS and MDH primarily to look at the early dollars that were expended and pursuing FEMA where we can.
Mm. Representative Nora.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that brings me to the bill that I already have, which is for the food insecurity, that we may need to bring that forward as soon as possible because it's asking for $10 million, which also supports the restaurants according to the Feed Act, which was a bill that was sponsored in the federal government. Sometimes our systems don't align. I think it's important that we bring and value things that we can immediately take advantage of the 100% FEMA reimbursement. So I'll ask you to find ways, if we cannot negotiate with my colleagues, to ensure that we support the families of struggling. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this really is a discussion with additional information that I recently acquired in regards to something that Chair Mariani talked about, and that's the free and reduced lunch program. I talked to both superintendents of my two districts, school districts, over the weekend, and both of them mentioned the unintended consequences of the executive orders allowing for free lunches through the school system because of COVID. And what they said is that because of that, families chose not to fill out because they didn't need to. The challenge with that, as they clearly identify, is that they have lower numbers, which means that next year their reimbursements for not only the food program, but other programs that use free and reduced lunches as their guidance is going to be way down, which means they're going to be dealing with a lot less revenue. And then the following year, when the applications come back up again, or the following program year, it's going to be up again. And so that blip is going to kind of cause a reduction in what appears to be expenses from the Department of Education with a following increase the following year. So it's an unintended consequence that I think we need to keep in mind when we put some of those budgets together and understand that that is some of the fallout. And so, Madam Chair, that was just additional information for you to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. That's good insight. And last, we have Representative Marquardt.
So, well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. So we know that even though the budget numbers got better on Friday, the lives of hundreds of thousands of families did not get better on Friday. And, you know, on the expense side of the forecast, it actually shows on the baseline that's going to go down $455 million, roughly close to 1%. And we know that the forecast assumes that current law is going to stay, which means funding and policy will remain unchanged. And I think the only changes are in caseload or enrollment or, you know, projected formula changes. And yet we know with COVID-19 that we're going to have some unique challenges and some unique investments we're going to have to make. I mean, we already know that are above enrollment or whatever. If we even talk about education, we know that we've got students that have to get caught up. That's going to take extra investment. We know there are families that their jobs may not be there in a post-pandemic time. They're going to need retraining or extra help with spending businesses. There's going to be extra expenses required to just get them back and running at on all cylinders, or later on to maybe even retrofit. So I guess the question is, we know there are going to be all sorts of additional pressures on the expenditure side that are going to impact our investments, both in tax policy and appropriations, on those that impact our students and our families and our businesses. Is there anything worked in to the forecast that assumes these unique expenditures and challenges that we face during this COVID-19 time?
Mm. Commissioner Showalter.
Interesting question, Madam Chair, Representative. The easy, straightforward answer is no, because the forecast reflects current state law. And so to the extent that there's laws or programs that are targeted towards the unique circumstances that we find ourselves today, it's not in the forecast unless it's already on the books. Obviously, there are programs that are out there that address some of the needs or some of the issues or are going to be working to get there. You know, that's part of how we've been, you know, continuing to manage state programs to make sure that we're trying to get to the people and the needs within the current boundaries. But to your question, Representative, you know, it's a current law state budget. And so a lot of the considerations, a lot of the detail that we're trying to bring out in this presentation is exactly the kind of information you need to assess for the upcoming budget.
Okay. Representative.
So, well, very good. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you and everyone for your great work on this. Thanks, Madam Chair.
So we do have another question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, Madam Chair, I'm going to revert back to some comments that you made at the onset of this committee hearing, and it pose a question to you, actually for elaboration. You mentioned in your opening comments that the state needed to seek out or move towards more reliable revenue enhancements. And for the purposes of this committee, from a fiscal perspective, I'm wondering if you could help clarify for me what you meant by that statement, and if you could provide some specificity in terms of how you would intend or what programs or initiatives that would include.
Yeah, well, thank you, Representative Albright. Good to hear your voice. So I think my opening statement, you know, excited or as happy as I am to see that, you know, the February forecast is better than we thought. For $1.6 billion, you know, it's there. And so, you know, my remarks opening up was kind of like what we just heard Representative Marquardt talk about, that, you know, there are families, you know, although the forecast is brighter today than we thought it would be, there are still families out there where their lives have been impacted by this COVID-19, where they're still are not working, where they're worried about their mortgage or their rent, where we still have small businesses who have been impacted. And a lot of those are those micro businesses who are still being impacted by this pandemic. And so as we look to not just to, you know, tomorrow, but to the future, we have to look at what do we have in place that would allow us as a state to and make those type of investment into the small business, into people's lives, and to get our economy and ensure that our state economy is moving forward. So that's kind of like what that was statement was about.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I don't see any further questions. So I really would like to thank Commissioner Showalter and who do we have here? And Dr. Coloma Kiedis and Director Raitoff for your presentation today. And with that, members, that concludes our business for the day. I am not sure whether we will need to meet next week, but please keep your eyes on your inboxes for any and all updates. With that, we are adjourned.